both felt like what we had was very much worth fighting for, and to her it was worth dying for.
Mina liked pink a lot. That was her signature color. If she could have put the world in pink, she would have done that.
Sarah was more of the tomboy, really reserved.
I don't think I ever saw Sarah without a smile on her face.
We were just attracted to each other. On every level, we were just connected. She was the kind of person I could have had the worst day. Within a minute of being around her, nothing else mattered. She just had a very strong presence about her. All she really said was that her dad was strict. And the relationship progressed. She would tell me more and more horror stories about him, basically.
I was with my sister, and my mom called me and told me that Amina said that her dad had touched her. She was so afraid of Yasser, she would not even use a public telephone because she said he gets in everywhere, he knows everything.
My mother came into my room and she woke me up and she was like, I have to tell you something horrible.
How do you tell your child that the love of his life is no more?
I couldn't believe it. Like, it was just so surreal.
He clearly would have had to have a plan on how to get out of town.
How can you have that much blood on you and walk away from a crime scene without nobody seeing you? Somebody picked him up.
I don't think he ever left the States. I believe he's been here the whole time.
Now, for the first time, the FBI says this may have been an honor killing.
The shame that the family feels because of the woman's behavior causes them to kill her to restore the honor.
We had eye contact. He had a cap over his head, but he still had his mustache.
This is Blissville, Misadventures in Blissville. I'm your host, David Lawler, and I'm talking to an old colleague, old-slash-employer, unpaid, from back in the days when I was making a lot of movies. We're talking with, and I like to call her, Nagme, but she insists that we all call her Nina. And she has made a film called The Price of Honor. Now, this comes from the Huffington Post on their blog spot, and it's basically a description of the movie. The Price of Honor, a new documentary about the horror of honor killing, opens with a highly disturbing audio recording call, 911, Texas teenager Sarah Saeed, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Screaming that her father's shooting her and her elder sister Amina. Tragically, both girls were murdered that day on January 1st, 2008. Meanwhile, their killer and their father, Yasser Saeed, who shot Amina twice and Sarah nine times under the pretense of defending the family honor, escaped the police and remains on the FBI most wanted list to this day. Now, a quick trip to Wikipedia reveals this about honor killings. An honor killing is the homicide of a member of a family or social group by other members due to the perpetrator's belief that the victim has brought shame or dishonor upon the family or community, usually for reasons such as refusing to enter an arranged marriage, being in a relationship that is disapproved by their relatives, having sex outside marriage, becoming the victim of rape, dressing in ways which are deemed inappropriate, or engaging in homosexual relations. This has become, more recently, a very hot topic. I've been seeing a lot more of it. Killer Instinct by Jane Hampshire. She was a producer on the film Natural Born Killers that was directed by Oliver Stone. She and her producing partner, Don Murphy, actually brought the project to Oliver Stone. But back when she was paying her dues and studying film at USC, she had to deal with a guy. The guy who checks out the film equipment for student films and projects. His name was Aziz Ghazal. From what I understand, he was born in Israel, but his mother was Jewish, his father was Arab. He's no longer with us, neither is his daughter or his estranged, divorced wife. They're all dead. By all accounts, he was unstable, to say the least. Hampshire and Don Murphy's experiences with him were most of the time miserable, but they did enjoy spending time with his wife and daughter. and he was very respected in his position at USC, produced a low-budget film called Zombie High, which was really kind of a bad film anyway, but Virginia Madsen and Richard Cox were in it. Then he optioned a Gregory MacDonald book called The Brave, which he took to Oliver Stone and Jodie Foster, but they turned it down. Eventually, Johnny Depp bought the rights and made a movie with Marlon Brando. I don't think it ever got released. I think it wound up in a film festival, and that was a couple of years later. So by late 93, his wife divorced him. Basically, she filed criminal charges. There were violence, loud arguments, and threats. His daughter started seeing a boy, which he did not approve, and this seemed to be the impetus of those honor killings. The idea that these men, fathers, husbands, view their families, this is how I see it anyway, view their families as possessions, and they exist at the pleasure of a peculiar patriarchy. So at the beginning of December of 1993, he killed his wife and daughter and set fire to their home on Cedar Drive in Pine Cove, California, which is near Palm Springs. The house is up for sale right now. It's $349,000, and it's a very nice piece of property. I remember reading about this. It was really just a footnote in the story of getting Natural Born Killers made. And it's a really good book, actually, if you want to know anything about how the Hollywood studio system works these days. But I was thinking when I read this about Aziz Ghazal and what happened, I thought, this is insane. This is nothing that could happen in real life. This seemed more like a horror movie. So I wanted to ask, as you've had this experience of having to, how long have you known about this unusual cultural phenomena?
Well, being from the Middle East myself, it's we know about it. You know, it's part of, I mean, I remember growing up, I was always deathly afraid if I ever did anything that was deemed dishonorable, that, you know, not that my life would be in danger, but it would be such a disgrace to my family. I remember, you know, in high school, my friends would joke around, like, saying things like, oh, if my dad ever would find out, he would kill me. Even though they said in a joke, for me, that was a very high possibility. I mean, I was fortunate where, I mean, my parents loved me and whatnot, and they weren't as strict, but there was always that little sense of, if I ever did anything that was disgraceful, I would be better off dead. So innately, even though my parents never threatened us or never had, you know, said we will kill you, I think just growing up in that culture, as a woman, you just have it in your mind that you can't cross the line, that your life is really in jeopardy if you do.
So growing up in your family, was it that strict?
It was strict to a point. Like, I wasn't allowed to date boys. I wasn't, you know, couldn't really have sleepovers or go to a friend's house for sleepover. It was strict, but not as strict as some families and some other people that I knew. And like I said, I mean, my parents brought us here for a better life. So there was, I mean, and they knew that.
Well, how old were you when they brought you here?
I came here when I was 9.
9. So you had spent a considerable portion of your childhood in Iran, right?
Yeah, in Iran and in Dubai. We left Iran pretty much right after, a few years after the revolution, because my dad was very pro-Shah. And we went to Dubai, and me and my mom would still go back to Iran during the summer times. He wasn't allowed to. Both of my brothers were actually born in Dubai. And then me and my dad came here, and 2.5 years later, my mom and my brothers came.
Now, how Americanized are you? I know you're, how much of your culture did you assimilate, if any, or did you wholeheartedly embrace American culture when you came here?
When I came here, I think I was a little confused. I didn't understand right. What was happening, why we were here. I would like to think that I still am a lot more Iranian than an American, or at least I'm trying to balance the two more, you know. So growing up, it was difficult. Because I would see my friends who were allowed to do these things and I wasn't, and I couldn't understand why. You know,
right.
Why wasn't I allowed to have sleepovers? Why wasn't I allowed to, you know, play sports and all these other things where everybody else was doing it? So in that aspect, it was hard at first.
So they retained a lot of that culture coming here?
They did at first, and I think, but throughout the years, like, you know, in high school, I joined the softball team and stuff. So throughout the years, I think they got less Because they knew, I mean, they brought us here. They knew that we had to acclimate to what was, you know, the culture here. You know, we couldn't keep the old ways. So in that aspect, I'm very grateful because, like I said, my parents, you know, they were
open-minded enough.
Yeah, they were open-minded and modern enough in their thinking, you know, to let me move ahead and, you know, kind of get accustomed to the American way of life. But they still, you know, kind of wanted us to, I mean, one of the strict things was we always had to speak Farsi at home. But when you were
in, like, mixed company with Americans, you would speak English?
Yeah, yeah. So for those things I'm grateful for because it kept me rooted as for to who I am, you know. So I think I like to say right now I have a good balance of both, but I don't know.
I'm a modern American, I guess. I can't grasp this concept because I think it comes from core religious principles. These are considered principles. I mean, it's sort of, if the family shames you, they must die. It's almost like mafia-like, like Cosa Nostra, made men biting of a bullet, as part of a tradition. It's something I can't really grasp, I guess, as an American. But there was something here. This lady named Dia Khan produced a documentary called Bonanza Love Story.
Yes.
And she says honor killings and forced marriages are not a Muslim thing, that they happen in Sikh, in Hindu, even in Christian societies, structured so that the rights of the group are enforced at the expense of the individual. It's kind of a, she's going off on a philosophical tangent, and it sounds like she doesn't like socialism, but whatever. But she's probably referring to Mormons and people like that, and the predilection for collecting wives like we collect Star Wars figures, and making Christmas extremely complicated. But what we're addressing here is the violence of an ancient culture that sends messages through beheadings, mm-hmm. essentially. Some of us prefer Facebook or Skype, but other people like to send messages through beheadings. I'm just trying to make a joke there, sorry. Anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit about this Yasser Saeed. From what I understand, the FBI was reluctant, or maybe local law enforcement authorities were reluctant to have the FBI involved in on this investigation because honor killings are a form of hate crime, right?
Yes, yes.
And the FBI, who didn't want to pursue it in that manner?
Well, the interesting thing is when it first happened, they labeled it as an honor killing, and then they distracted that, and we don't know why. We don't know if they were trying to be more PC, because, I mean, in Dallas, there's a huge Muslim community, so they stopped calling it an honor killing, and we really honestly don't know why. We've tried to get in touch with the FBI. They've talked to us, but they wouldn't really answer any of our questions.
Has the FBI used any of the information you accumulated in the making of your film for their investigation?
Well, yeah, the interesting thing is when they finally did talk to us, we handed over all the information that we had, and literally within days, they were in the news saying how they raised the award from $10,000 to $20,000 for his arrest or any information on him, as well as they posted a huge wanted poster in Times Square. But they said they didn't say they got the information from us. But there was
so you did assist, you assisted in
yeah,
the
they
investigation.
Yeah, they got a tip, whatnot. But whether they actually did anything with the actual information that we gave them, that I do not know. Because we literally kind of, I don't want to say handed him to them, but we pretty much told them where he could possibly be. But they haven't made the arrest yet, so we don't know. And what happened was the reason the FBI got involved is they believed that he left the state. So once a criminal leaves the state, then that's when it becomes an FBI case. Initially, they thought maybe he went to New York because he has a brother in New York, and then they assumed that he went to Egypt. And that's when they kind of...
Right, people thought he was driving a cab in New York, right?
Right, at one point, because his brother does that. Once they had the idea that he was in Egypt, that's when they kind of just went cold with the case and didn't really pursue it.
This was something... If what Yasser Saeed committed was indeed an honor killing, why would he run? Why is he a fugitive now? Would it not be more honorable to stand for, no matter how horrible it might be, the cause of honor, if this is how honor is viewed? He is protecting the family legacy or something like that. But then he runs.
Because he's a coward. And, right. You know, one thing we learned was this was not the first time he's killed someone. He killed a coworker back in Abu Dhabi, and his father paid the cops and paid the police and got him out of there, and that's the reason why he came to the States. So he apparently has a history of killing and running away.
He was already unstable. Is it possible that someone could retain a level of honor within their family, but not involve themselves in murder to retain that honor? Is it possible that through reason, through common sense, everything else, that such honor could be maintained instead of this rather absurd reaction?
Not to these people's minds, no. To these people's mind, this is the only way, unfortunately. And going back to what you said earlier about it being religious-based, it's not. And that's one of the misconceptions that the media portrays this as being Muslim. But unfortunately, we're talking about tribal laws that go back thousands of years. Once we started having patriarchal societies and we forgot the whole thing about, you know, the goddess and Mother Nature and all that, once it became very patriarchal, that's when all this started happening. So it's not religious-based at all. It's more tribal laws that go back for generations.
I've read the Quran, and there seems to be an enormous amount of violence advocated against enemies of Islam, against Jews in particular. There's a lot of interesting stuff there about basically about how to kill Jews. I don't subscribe to that, but in the day-to-day reality, murder is can still a crime even in what might be an antiquated tribal culture. But it comes from the fanaticism of what I understand is a deviation of Sharia law,
right?
Which is like the moral code of Islam.
But you know, people like Yasser and a lot of these people that do these are not religious. You know, like Yasser was not a religious man.
He wasn't a religious family.
No, not at all.
If they occur in predominantly Muslim provinces within the strict accordance of Sharia law, would they be considered crimes? Are they considered crimes there? Or would they be accepted practice?
That's the issue we're having in general in terms of like culturally, because a lot of times, even though the government say, well, no, we don't, you know, support it, but a lot of the local government, local police, they'll kind of turn the blind eye. They know it happens, they see it, but they won't do anything about it.
And then murder is sort of accepted in this sense,
yes.
So what follows would be more extreme examples of what we here in America call antisocial behavior. Are we looking at a society that's falling apart because of its inherent ability to exist in a modern age where there's theoretically less violence? I mean, if you look at statistics, violence and violent crime has gone down significantly. Will there be more understanding or tolerance in the future, or is that society just a victim of the entropy of its ancient culture?
I think it's a society that wants to keep it its old ways. It doesn't want to move ahead. You know, like I said, these are laws that have been passed down for generations. We talk about small villages and these, you know, countries that have not advanced in any sense of the word, where there's technology or education. When you said the crime is down, are you talking about just in our society, like the Western society?
In our society in general, in America, I know we look at the media, and the media wants everyone to panic most of the time anyway, right? to be afraid. But on the whole, the violence has gone down more. I think we're looking at more of a younger generation becoming involved. Older ideas are parting, and it's taking a very long time, but it will happen, I believe, in a place that has the deviation of Sharia law and all the violence that it breeds. I mean, there is a lot of violence, and extremists over there are not the same as extremists over here.
Right.
Because we have, you know, we have cheeseburgers and french fries and lottery and sitcoms and reality shows. We have, like, we have a lot of anesthetizing agents in pop culture that sort of keep us from getting into too much trouble. I don't know how it is over there, though. I do know that Iran is fairly modern for a country. I've known a few people from there. They do more or less, I mean, the young people at least do more or less what the young people do here. They go to the movies, they watch TV, but I don't know how much of what they say is controlled by either their media or their religion or their politics.
Well, I mean, I've been to Iran, and it is. And again, like things like honor killings, even though they still do happen in Iran, they tend to happen a lot more in like small villages, small like towns and areas where they're very disconnected from, you know, the rest of the world. But if you go to cities like Tehran and you know, those major cities, it's very modern, you know.
Yes.
Guys and girls, and you know, the guys dressed to the T, and more, it's like watching a fashion show. And it's,
yes.
So, and again, it has to do a lot with education and being able to move forward as a society. And these little villages and places that are so remote, they don't have access to the education, and you know, and they don't want to move forward. They're stuck in their ways. And in terms of the violence and numbers, the problem we're having is, you know, we estimate 20,000 girls that get killed every year, but UN actually estimates there's a lot more because a lot of them do not get reported. So we don't know even the exact number, but it's definitely a lot more than 20,000.
So what is your opinion of a leader like Ahmadinejad? He was at Columbia University a couple of years ago, and Brahman works over there. So basically, part of her job was that she had to field a lot of questions and a lot of angry complaints from students and people because it was an extremely volatile situation having him there.
Right.
But I don't think they, a lot of people, I don't think our news really gives us the full story on everything. What do you think of his work as a leader or whatnot?
Well, he's not the leader anymore, so.
Not anymore, no.
Yeah, he's out. Well, like you said, you know, it's the media, they only tell you what they want you to hear. It's very one-sided. The whole issue with, you know, Iran and Israel, you only hear the one side. You know, you don't hear all the times how Iran was willing to cooperate and all the times that they came back with deals and, you know, Israel turned it down or the U.S. turned it down. So you never hear about those things. You only hear about, you know, the negative parts. For Ahmadinejad, I mean, you have to understand the what we call presidents over there, they're really just the puppets of the parliament, the puppets of the what we call the high leader, the mullah.
It's sort of like what we have here with corporations.
Right.
Our religion is corporations in a way, because they seem to guide our lives. And most of our elected leaders are, I would consider them to be nothing more than figureheads for the most part. That's sort of how I see it.
Yeah. And same thing over there, you know, with him. He stood his ground. One thing I have to say, though, I liked about him was the fact he stood his ground with Bush. He was like, you know what, fuck you. You don't. I think America has this idea is if they don't agree with something, then it's wrong.
Right.
You can't, especially in politics and, you know, in socioeconomical things, you can't go into it thinking like that. You can't be like, you can't go to another culture and say, well, you're doing this, that's wrong. Because that's not how we do it here.
I liked that the Ahmadinejad did acknowledge that there is a Christian God in a way. They sort of understand that a lot of people here like Jesus or something. I don't know. Where do you stand on Palestinian liberation or retaining Israel?
Oh God, you're gonna get into that?
Well, give me 30 seconds. Give me a nice controversial soundbite.
I think there should be a Palestinian liberation. I think they have a right to their own country. You know, we gave Israel to the Jews. Actually, we shouldn't say we. It was England that did it. So
1948, right?
Yeah. You know, for them to push the Palestinians out and say, no, this is our land, I think it's very wrong.
Well, they got to have some place to go,
I have to say, though, I've been to Israel, and, you know, I'm not, like, anti-Jew by all means or anti-Israel by all means. I mean, when I went there, I'll be honest, I, you know, all my stuff actually got stolen, and they were the nicest people. They helped me more than the U.S. embassy there. You know, the U.S. embassy basically pretty much threw me on the street and said, well, you're on your own, fend for yourself. Well, the Israelis, they took me in, they would give me money, they helped, you know, I think politically And this is the problem. When politics going to happen, it's, you know, the general public that suffers.
You have just received an award for your film. Tell us a little about that. That just happened. You made the announcement on Facebook not 2-3 hours ago, I guess. When I opened up, I saw it. So if you could tell us a little bit about that, what happened?
I honestly have no idea. My partner texted me. He's like, check your email. And I checked my email, and there was we got a letter for this award, which, I could go look it up in my other laptop. But yeah, it's for the best documentary, and we're
That's
very excited.
That's fantastic.
We've sent it to a bunch of festivals, so hopefully there'll be more good news coming our way, I hope.
But yeah, I think you're gonna get a lot of exposure as a result of this. This is, like I said, it's a very touchy subject. It's something Americans, at least, they're not gonna understand it because it.
Right.
It seems like it's really, I mean, we have our sociopaths here, but they usually do things of their own accord. But I wanted to make mention of the fact that Nina worked with us a long time ago when I was making films. I remember, from what I understand, I didn't even put like an ad out for a crew or anything. I think you sent in a note. Because I was working on something. They only come out at night. I made a movie in 2000. I think it was 2000. And you sent in a regular note saying, I'm not an actress, but if you need anybody on the crew, I'm capable and I'm quick and all that. And I was like, hell, come on in. So
yeah.
You just sort of came in.
Yep.
And then I was, I know what I did. I made you put together a tripod in like less than 3 minutes. I think that's what I did. I was like, okay, you see that tripod? Open it up and put a camera on it, and I'm going to time you. I was like, I had balls back then, believe me. So the last thing we worked on a couple of films together.
Yes.
You were always there. You came. We worked on They Only Come Out at Night. We worked on Legia. Were you on Legia with us? Yes, you were.
Yes, I was.
You were, because I remember that. And we worked on Vortex. We went upstate. Well, we shot Legia. Legia actually did get a distribution deal. I didn't make a damn penny off of it, which was hilarious. But it was on DVD. I don't know if you ever got a DVD, did you?
No, you owe me 3 DVDs by now.
I've got like 5 million of them down in the basement. They're still in the box. I'll send you something. Send me your mailing address and I'll send you off a million things. Anyway. And then we worked on Vortex, and I remember we went upstate and you were like down for a whole day because your allergies kicked in. Which is like... And this is why you're Americanized, Nina, because you get allergies. Because you were there and you were completely down and you were on the couch and just your whole face was red. And the last thing we worked on together was the documentary we did, American Punk, which I'm actually, I'm going to put that out, and people are going to be able to see it finally, because I'm going to have a YouTube channel corresponding with this podcast, so we can get video footage. But you helped shoot some of the interviews, and it was a very piecemeal production. We couldn't get you there all the time because all the rock bands, all the punk bands that we were recording, they would give us short notice, and me and Scott and Bronwyn would have to go out there and shoot live performances, and it was exhausting. But you were there for a lot of the interview pieces.
Yes.
Now, the thing about this is it's much harder. A lot of people aren't aware of this because they think you just pick up a camera and shoot. But it's actually a lot harder to shoot a documentary than a regular narrative, basically because you're not following a script. Everything is sort of improvised right away, and I'm sure when you were working on your film, there were people that would come in and say, oh, by the way, did I tell you this? We have to go and shoot this person because they want to talk to us. So did you learn anything from your experience working with us when you started working on The Price of Honor?
Patience. Have lots of patience.
Elaborate.
It took us 4 years from finish to start. For the Price of Honor, so yeah, and I remember working with you. It was like long days.
It was very long, very long.
Yeah.
But at least people could get naps, though, you know. I mean, when nobody was having to get... You were always getting naps, you know.
I was not.
Yeah, you were always, like, if nobody needed you, you went and took a nap. You went and laid down or something like that, which was cool. That was fine. Because I wanted to get naps half the time anyway. American Punk took about 3 years to shoot, about a year and a half to 2 years to edit, because it was just, we had, like, millions of tapes. So you had millions of tapes. How long did it take you to edit this movie?
Well, luckily we found an awesome editor who, I mean, we had over like 4,000 hours of footage. And what we had to do was initially we had to actually hire a writer to kind of help us break down the structure for the documentary, which was a huge help. And, you know, we had gotten some interns that transcribed a lot of the interviews and stuff, which, again, that was a huge help. I think the editing took about 8 months. You know, he, like I said, we got very lucky to find an editor who became very passionate about the story and wanted to be involved and put a lot of hours into it. So, yeah, I think it was about 7 to 8 months for.
So, what drove you to do this? Because it's I know you your position on honor killings and the subject, and also just the absolute horrendous murder. I'm a father, and I have a daughter, and she's going to be 8 on Christmas, and I just can't imagine this. This is like something that goes outside any ideology I've ever known about or been exposed to. I think you're hearing her in the background there,
yeah.
Too.
Yeah.
So I can say from when I was working on American Punk, I knew a couple of these people that were associated with the project, and I was like, you know what, I know a lot about them. One particular musician had done music for like an old video project that I did, so I was still in contact with them. And then it got very interesting to me, the whole idea of these musicians telling their stories. They weren't exactly the most successful, but they always had an interesting story. So when you started working on this, what did it start with? What was the seed of what you were shooting that you finally said, hey, this could make a good movie?
It was, well, a couple of years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, me and Joel, we started our production company. And the thing was, I've always loved documentaries. I've always loved, you know, stories that had a human touch to it. And when we started a production company, the thing we wanted to do was, we didn't want to make a typical Hollywood bam, bam, big, special effects kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of trying to think about what we want our first project to be. And it was around the same time where the media was starting to cover a lot about honor killings. There was, you know, things that were happening in Afghanistan with the Taliban. And it was also around the time where the stoning of Soraya was coming out.
Right.
I don't know if you watched that movie or not, but so we kind of were like, okay, well, this is, you know, and I was familiar with it, and he wasn't, so I was like, well, this is perfect. American people don't know about this. So
right.
What we wanted to do originally was to kind of cover a couple, then we did, and I remember when I was actually living in New York, I don't know if you remember or not, if you remember reading about it, but there was a case of a Pakistani girl that got murdered by her father.
What year was this? This was...
I'm going to say...
This is way back. Right?
Yeah. And that's the way I always struck, you know, stayed in my head. So when we think about projects, and I kind of remember that story, and I was like, you know, honor killings is not something that Americans know really anything about. But yet they're happening here in the States. So what we wanted to do was we were going to kind of take a couple of cases. Like there was the one in Arizona, there was one in New York, and there was another one, I think, in Canada, kind of talk about those cases, educate the public about honor killings and stuff. And then when we learned about Sarah Amina's case, honestly, it kind of started taking a life of its own. And it was the only case where the father hadn't been caught. And the more we delved into it, the more it kind of just became its own story. We're like, okay, then we kind of let it, you know, the documentary kind of take its own shape. And it really started to focus on Amina and Sarah, and we're like, well, this is the direction it's going, let's go with it. And we did, and like I said, it took us 4 years from gathering the information, getting doing all the research, getting all the interviews. I have to say, definitely one of the biggest challenges was getting people to talk to us, because even though it's been, you know, 6 years since the murders, there were still a lot of people that lived in fear.
They were nervous.
Yeah, they were nervous and scared. I mean, the two friends that the girls ran away with at one point, they refused to talk to us because they were so afraid, you know, of the Saeed family.
So it became bigger, and this is the story with a number of documentaries. Sometimes the documentary will start off on one subject but wind up becoming about something completely else. I'm thinking of, I think Capturing the Freedmen started out as a documentary about a clown who entertains children. And when they dug deeper, they found out he was related to this family that, and it started this whole story, this massive story about the sexual molestation charges in Long Island. It started as something else, and I think that's probably where a number of documentaries, I know you're probably familiar with the work of Michael Moore.
Yes, yes.
And Michael Moore has a tendency, I think he's a wonderful filmmaker, but for me, he has a tendency to get too personally involved with his subjects. He gets a little too passionate about. Most of the time, I always consider the documentary to be very objective, takes a subject and studies it, mm-hmm. Interviews people who were witness or can provide a little bit of expert commentary, and then it's up to the audience to make their own decision. Now, have you leaned very far passionately into this subject? Is it something in the film? Do you take all of this personally, or are you trying to maintain a discreet distance from your subjects?
I think in this case, and I think in certain documentaries, it's very hard to do, because getting to know the girls, we felt like we knew them. And I remember the first time we went to the cemetery, and for me, it was like, it was kind of like a reality check, like, oh my God, they're really dead. You know, for 3 years, all we'd seen were like emails and letters and pictures, but when you actually visit the cemetery where they're lying and they're like under the ground right there, and you're looking at them, and you're like, oh my God. I think it was hard, you know, and the people that we talked to, I mean, Amina's boyfriend, Joseph, here's this big guy, tall, 6 foot, you know, but he's so emotionally still after all these years distraught. And so, like, you know, see him break down in an interview and cry, after, you know, when he hasn't cried in 6 years, it was just like, so moments like that, it was definitely very hard to try to be objective, you know. And definitely there were times when the second interview we did with the mom, it was very hard to not be angry at her.
The mother, can we get into that a little bit? I understand there's a little bit of moral ambiguity where she's concerned.
Yes.
What was it? Was she... Because it isn't, from what I've read of Anna Killings, it isn't always necessarily a father exacting some kind of social vengeance or justice upon his family for shaming him. I've read stories about families mm-hmm. getting in on this. And acting as a group.
Yes.
So what can you tell us a little bit about the mother and what her attitude was?
Other than the fact she's a pathological liar. Okay. Here's the thing. Patricia likes to play the victim. It's like, oh, woo me. Oh, I lost two daughters and this and that. She plays that role really well.
All right.
But here's my thing. When the girls at one point, the girls ran away because they just had enough. They take the mom with them. The mom, they go to an aunt's house, and the aunt asks specifically, are you going to go back? She says, no, if I go back, he's going to kill the girls. You knew your daughter's lives were in danger.
Yeah.
Yet you still choose to bring them back. Now, I'm sorry, I don't have children, so one might argue, like, you know, who am I to judge or who am I to say, but I know if ever, even if it's not my child, but my niece or nephew, if their life is ever in danger, why would I ever take them back? So right. For me, it's hard to understand why she would do that, you know?
From the parent's perspective, I can safely say that everything our children do, we are inextricably tied to them. We keep them out of danger, and that's really the role.
Exactly. She didn't do that. She failed to do that. And the funny thing is, if you know, we try to kind of portray it a little bit in the documentary, but the first interview we did, she was emotional, very like, you know, like I said, poor me. But the interesting thing that I had noticed right away was that she would never look directly at me or at the camera or anything. She was always, you know, kind of keeping her eyes down. The second time, the second interview we did about a year and a half later after the first, she was absolutely cold as ice. Yeah. Not only that, she contradicted everything she said in the first interview. So I think she's gotten to a point where she can't even keep up with her own lies. Even through the whole process, you know, we kind of had to stay friends with her just so if we needed anything from her. It was always about her. It was never about the girls. It was always about her. So there was just a lot of red flags.
Right. So,
and I, you know, for me, my personal opinion, she is involved just as much as Yasser. She might have not pulled the trigger, but she's just as guilty.
What is your position on church and state? Do you think church and state could peacefully coexist, at least in this country? Or I don't really think there's going to be much improvement in places where you say we have a combination of modern society and then we still have tribal law. But what would you think about church and state?
Well, there is no separation. Okay. At least not here. It doesn't seem like it. You know, when you have the whole Republican parties basing everything, all the belief system, bringing it into politics, like, you know, the whole thing in abortion, the whole thing on gay marriage, it's all religious belief. Where's the separation?
Well, I'm not going to put all the blame on the Republican Party. I think other parties do. I don't really consider myself Democrat or Republican. I don't really follow that. I did get maybe a tad bit more conservative when my daughter was born, I suppose. Because I was thinking about her. Eleanor Killings would be put in the category, I would have to, as an American, I'd put it in the category of religious fanaticism. But just as other groups and political parties tend to use labels, those labels often become cliche and then they become stereotypes. So too often we see a lot of crime committed in the name of ideology in the United States.
Exactly.
After the terrorist attacks of September 11th, of 2001, many groups were assaulted and attacked. I'd hear stories about Sikh, Hindi, even dark-skinned Asians being attacked because you, as American, you tend to lump all those all the people into the same category.
Right.
And if there's anything that we're really good at as Americans, I'm going to say it is prejudice. That is pretty much what we do. It's like the laziest thing you can do. It's the laziest atrocity because, you know, Americans tend to be a bit on the lazy side. It's handed down generation to generation, person to person, father to son, mother to daughter. I have neighbors on my block. They're the sweetest people in the world. They really are. They have two very beautiful daughters. They're from Saudi Arabia. And I know that when September 11th came around, they pretty much stayed inside because of where we live. But they are the nicest people in the world. Unfortunately, they identify themselves very much as coming from Saudi Arabia, which might, because we look on the surface and we see that they have different customs and they wear different clothing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not permitted in the house if the wife is not wearing something over her head. Women are allowed, but men aren't. That's just part of the tradition or whatever. But I would think that if you come to this country, you should at least try to be one of us in that way. What would you say to that? I'm a strict white male American. I'm just putting that out there.
Well, again, it's kind of like the thing, like, just because you don't agree with it doesn't mean that it's wrong. You know, yes, we come here. I think we should, you know, accolade a little bit to the society here and kind of, you know, have a good balance of how you were raised back home and how you are here. You know, I remember when I first came here, I was very, very upset when I would see women wearing the hijab because in my mind, I'm like, you're here, you're free, why are you wearing that? You know, where back in Iran where we were forced to wear it. So right. For me, I struggle with that too, but, you know, I had to grow and understand, well, that's, if they choose that, if that's what they choose, then they should have the right to. And again, you know, the whole thing with men not going around allowed to go in. That has a lot to do with, you know, respect and whatnot. And I think you just, for Americans, they have to be a little bit more open-minded, just, you know, like, and try to understand other cultures a little bit better.
Yes.
You know, we can't just point fingers and say, well, that's not right, because that's not how we do it here. Because think about it, we all came here on a boat too. The Indians were here first. I'm sure we did a lot of things that the Indians didn't like, you know,
yes.
And that's not right. But we did it anyway, so.
Yes, absolutely.
I think, the world has become such a melting pot as it is that it's all going to blend together one way or another.
That's my hope, actually. Going back to that original point, yes, my family came here from Germany and Ireland. My relatives from Germany, they very much assimilated into the culture. They considered it rude and wrong to speak their language in front of Americans. They wanted to work very hard to learn English, and they did. And I suppose they prospered in their way back in those days. But to the second point, yes, I fervently hope that we will become so mixed as a species, the human race, whatever it is, and so much so that we can never tell that we all look alike, that we should all be the same. That's really what we should be. We should totally be the same. That's my commentary. Thank you.
And we are. If you really think about it, down to the core, we really are the same. It's
just... Yes, for crying out loud. We eat, we sleep, we reproduce. That's what we are.
Right.
On that hopeful, cheery note, I'm going to end this podcast. And this has been really fantastic. And once again, I remember us having a couple of deep conversations, and for some reason you always make me see your point of view. So there you go. If filmmaking doesn't work out, go for politics. So.
You think I should be a politician? What do you think?
I, you know, give it about 5 or 10 years.
Would you vote for me?
Yeah, I might. I might actually vote. The last time I voted was in 1992. So I urge you to visit www.theprice of honor.com. Look at The Price of Honor on the Facebook page. Lots of new updates are coming. I want to thank Nina. She has been fantastic, and it's been a really good experience.
Thank you. It's been nice catching up.
It has been very nice. When we get our RSS feed, please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you.